This Slate spoiler special is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 700,000 high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 30% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code SPOILER6.
Hi, this is Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic, here with a Slate spoiler special on Man of Steel, the new Superman reboot directed by Zack Snyder. And joining me in the Slate studio are Brian Lauder and Forrest Wickman. You are both staff writers, primarily for Slate's Browbeat culture blog.
Yes.
And you both saw Superman the other night. Sorry, we're calling it Superman for short. Man of Steel
Man of Steel.
You guys saw it in 2D, right? Not 3D?
That's right.
Yep.
I don't think you missed that much. The 3D did not seem to add a lot to, to the mix. But so before we get started on spoiling, let's just get a quick reaction from both of you. Pro or con, would you send your friends to this movie?
I found it extremely technically impressive, like overwhelmingly technically impressive in terms of the sound, the effects, the design. I thought the acting was pretty good, but I still had a hard time getting caught up in it just because there weren't very many relatable human characters. So it just sort of felt like I was getting pummeled with excess, and I felt mixed about that.
Yeah, I agree. The pummeling, it's hard to get past the pummeling, and we'll get to that in a moment in superhero movies and how do they differentiate themselves, you know, now that it's become such a summer staple. But so, Brian, you had a somewhat more positive reaction.
Yeah, I guess I went in just sort of not liking superhero movies very much in general. The past, you know, couple years where we've seen a whole glut of them, I've never been really that into it. And this is the first one where I've ever really been invested in what was going on. No, it wasn't like a perfect movie, and it wasn't, I agree with Forrest that the characters are not exactly human, but I guess maybe I liked the pummeling. I thought it was a beautiful film. I thought the music was excellent. The graphic design was excellent. And I was sort of buzzing after it was over.
It's a particular kind of pummeling that Zack Snyder does.
Yeah.
I have to say, I mean, he's known for his graphic novel adaptations, right? And he's good at creating that graphic novel feeling in an image. For what that's worth, that doesn't necessarily translate to telling a story.
But. Sure, sure.
Yeah, it was probably the most expert pummeling I can think of.
All right, so you guys helped me reconstruct how this story is told. We basically all know the story. This is the Superman origin story, which incidentally was told only a few years ago in that last failed Superman reboot, right, which was called Superman Returns.
Superman Returns. Failed in retrospect, actually. It's been pointed out this week that it made $400 million. It caught their about $400 million. It cost about $200 million, it's been reported. So that's not a great take, but it's sort of surprising how it's become a flop in retrospect.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess
it was pretty well liked at the time. I liked it.
I guess I would just say it's failed in the sense that it didn't start anew, right? I mean, that particular program reboot didn't continue to run. So the origin story we all know, right? Superman as a baby is named Kal-El. He's shot off from Krypton into space by his parents. I don't think we see his mother in earlier Superman movies necessarily, do we? It's always his father, Jor-El, that we see launching him off into space.
Yeah.
But in this case, we see both the parents. I think the very first thing we witness is Superman's birth, right?
Yeah,
which, according to this movie's conceit, is the first live natural birth on Krypton in centuries.
That's right.
Because they have developed some sort of matrix-like system where these robot pods develop fetuses. I'm not quite sure what evildoer wanted that to happen or why that's in
place. Yeah. It seems like Krypton is some sort of communistic dystopia where everybody from birth is assigned a particular occupation. And so that's part of what Superman represents for the Kryptonians, is a break from that.
Yeah.
And this movie spends a lot of time, I mean, almost the first 20 minutes or so, establishing the world of Krypton, only to destroy it, right? But there's a lot of care put into the mythology and the design and the archetypal look of technology on Krypton. Let's talk about that stuff for a minute. I think that one of the movie's big successes actually was the design of Krypton and the ships coming from it.
Well, not only the design, but also the fact, I actually enjoyed the fact that they focused on that so much. I think part of why I've never been attracted to the Superman story in general is because it's very sort of Kansas American like plane, and in this movie we got to see so much of sort of an alien world. It was very sort of sci-fi heavy at the beginning, at least, and I thought that was a entertaining way to go for me personally, and as you say, it was gorgeously rendered.
The way the technology looks is clearly springs from some kind of concept. I mean, it looks sort of Art Nouveau-ish, actually.
Yes.
Right, everything's curved and organic kind of shapes and super sexual, like the capsule that they put the baby Kal-El in looks totally like a penis, but like not a super phallic one, right? Like a very rounded. Anyway, I thought it was cool looking stuff, but it was kind of pushing, you know, some sexuality boundaries in the way it looked.
Totally. Yeah, it had a little bit of like an H.R. Giger alien look to it. I'm surprised and glad that you really got caught up in the opening stuff. To me, there was just way too much like Kryptonian partisan politics at the beginning that I didn't understand. I didn't totally understand what was going on, because a lot of what they're arguing about, you only realize what the Codex is, for example, much later in the movie.
Oh yeah, the Codex.
Yeah,
so it's a complete MacGuffin, right? The Codex is, I guess, all of the encrypted genetic information of all of the people of Krypton,
which is
right.
somehow on like imprinted on a skull, like a half skull that he like finds and then beams into Superman's body. That was kind of bizarre. Yeah,
right. But you know, the first time you're watching the movie, I mean, maybe if you're a huge Superman fan who's kept up on all the comics, I imagine this has come up in the comics before, but otherwise you're just wondering why they're running around for this skull. And it's not,
I don't know about that. I have no idea how much of this is canon.
Yeah,
know,
I don't know.
I don't know either.
But I was thinking about, you know, why I couldn't get caught up in this at all, like the politics of this world. It reminded me of the beginning of Thor a lot, and in fact, way too much of Thor is like this. And I think it's possible to do, you know, Star Wars is all about like an alien world where people, a lot of people look like humans.
And diplomacy just like and all this stuff, right?
Yeah. But in Star Wars, you open with like that opening shot that's the tiny ship against the humongous one, and then you spend all this time getting to know Luke Skywalker when he's just like this small town kid on his farm taking the power converters to Tashi Station or whatever. And that makes him very relatable, like just like us. And you don't really get that in this. So I actually wish there was more of the sort of American heartland, you know, believing in the goodness of Kansas kind of stuff.
Yeah, you know, so there's two problems converging at the beginning on Krypton, right? One is that the core, which they've been mining, right? Yeah. I think one of the very first lines that Russell Crowe as Jor-El gets to say is something like, mining the core was madness, right?
Yeah.
So we know from the beginning that mining the core was a big mistake and it's going to collapse. But then there's also a war going on between the forces of General Zod, who's the bad guy, played by Michael Shannon, and I guess the rest of...
Yeah, it seems like everyone's unhappy with the High Council, both Superman's father, who represents sort of the science/peace side of society, and then General Zod, who's like the militaristic person. Neither one of them seems to be very happy with the decisions that the Council's made. And Zod, you know, chooses to sort of take over the society, I guess, even though the planet is collapsing around them. So it doesn't really matter, but...
Yeah, I didn't really get what Zod's end game was. If he was so against what Jor-El was doing, what was his attempt to save the planet? We don't know.
It's not
right?
clear. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's like a military coup to sort of assert control and make things work again.
But they couldn't stop. Presumably, they couldn't stop the reaction.
I don't know what his environmental
platform
was. Does
he say something about colonizing other planets at the beginning? I mean, that's clearly is what he tries to do at the end when, spoiler, they go and terraform the Earth and try to turn it into a Krypton-like
planet. That's
probably
what he was planning,
Right, colonization. Yeah. So we get the baby shot off into space in the penis pod, and he lands on the farm, as we all know, and this really is comic book canon, in Smallville, Kansas, in the farm of Jonathan and Martha Kent, played by Kevin Costner and Diane Lane, as his Earth parents who bring him up. And then that's when we get into this choppy temporal structure. Yep. Because I think the next time we see Superman after that, possibly he's grown up. He's being played by Henry Cavill.
He's on the oil rig, saving the oil rig.
Right, yeah. So we see him save a bunch of people on an oil rig with a beard. That's an odd moment, right? Seeing the young and very sort of slight-looking Superman with a beard. But then we start to cut back and forth between his childhood, this unusual child being brought up in Kansas, and his young adulthood and I think that this is unique, at least to Superman movies I've seen. He's not Clark Kent, nor is he the Kansas farm boy, but he's this kind of marginal figure,
nomadic,
having odd jobs on boats and things like that, basically drifting through the margins of society looking for people to save, but then quickly, you know, scurrying off and assuming a false identity. So that seems like a slightly new twist on Superman. This isn't one of those dark, he's not being turned into a Batman kind of anger motivated character, but he is made into someone, you know, a little bit shiftier and more insecure than we're used to seeing Superman be.
Yeah, so the central conflict of this part is, and sort of the whole movie, is just whether Superman should reveal himself, whether he should remain Clark Kent, or whether, you know, he should save people as Superman, but in turn tell everyone that there's aliens among them, and so freak them out, I guess, is what they're worried about. Is just he's worried about riots or something.
Yeah, his father, you know, John Kent, was definitely worried about that, and that's sort of a question that's debated, even with Lois Lane, once they meet. You know, is this a good idea to reveal this or not? Will people just want to kill him, or will they want him to actually help?
In fact, until General Zod comes back, which is relatively late in the movie, that's the major conflict of the movie, right, is the revelation of his true identity and what role he he should play in it, and also what role Lois Lane should play in it. And unusually for one of these movies, she finds out pretty early, right? Unlike Margot Kidder back in the Chris Reeve Superman days, she knows essentially from the first time he saves her from something, I can't remember what, that he is Superman and what he looks like. There's not any problematic conflict about figuring out who he is. The question is she going to report it, and who's going to find it out?
And speaking of that, though, it's funny how the movie ends when, you know, you mentioned that he's not a reporter for the Planet until the very end of the movie, basically. And I got the sense from that scene where she sees him, you know, as the new recruit to the paper, that she doesn't recognize him there. Is that what?
No.
I think it's a very knowing.
Okay. I wasn't sure. I was like, are we really supposed to believe that she can't tell who this guy is?
Well, if we're going to be jumping ahead to that moment, come on. I want to. But that reveal is so absurd at the end. The way the movie has set up this publicity situation, right? For one thing, in the days of the internet, which is barely mentioned, there is a kind of blogger character at one point who leaks some information about Superman.
Yes.
Woodburn, which as Forrest pointed out is kind of Woodward and Bernstein put together. Uh-huh. Give us a reporter name, quick, Woodburn. But there's not really any attention paid to the way rumors spread in the age of the internet and how difficult it would be to conceal his identity as Superman, especially given the fact that Lois Lane has already reported that Clark Kent is Superman and showed it to Lawrence Fishburne, who's playing her editor, right? So at least those two people know. It seems like it's very knowable information in the world that this movie posits. So, the already thin conceit that putting on glasses and a suit makes him into Clark Kent is just even more transparent at the end of this movie.
So we're taping on Thursday. I don't know when it goes up, but I know that Slate, in our science section, we actually have a piece coming about how Clark Kent's disguise work, how it works, like how he gets by only by putting on a pair of glasses, and the idea is that he surrounds himself entirely with people who have face blindness, and so none of them can tell that he's the same person.
Yeah,
that is a really silly nit to pick, but I'm just saying that given that these movies have to function on that conceit, they need to do a little bit of work to protect, whatever credibility that conceit could possibly have. So what else pops up from the middle of this movie that you guys want to talk about?
Well,
performances, any kind of, the special effects, the fight scenes?
Yeah, well, you were mentioning the cutting back and forth, and I think Forrest and I had different opinions about that as well. I thought that was useful because it kept us from having to sit in Kansas for so long and watch him sort of deal with finding his powers and being beaten up. And I thought we got enough of that over time to sort of understand his psychology and the backstory.
It's a pretty sophisticated structure.
Enjoyed it being, in parcels and then getting back to sort of the main, the main story of this movie. But I think you wanted more.
Yeah, I think I enjoy the pleasure of just watching superheroes discover their powers. I think that's the one great moment in every origin story. And we do get that here, but it's very disjointed because of how they keep cutting back and forth. And then I think there's also a problem with, so the central conflict of this part is whether or not Superman should reveal himself. And so over and over again, you get somebody that's in distress. You get all these kids on a bus. You get a woman being sexually harassed at a bar. You get an oil rig that's falling down. And so you get the same thing over and over again. And then ultimately his father in a tornado. And it seems like that should have happened maybe twice and not four times. Mm-hmm. If I'm probably forgetting more of
right,
him having
because it starts to become
decision.
Comical, right? It's like that
it's
part of
tedious.
His life is him trying to avoid having to save people, but he can't help it. Every bus he's on crashes, right? And every place he goes, there's a tornado or an oil rig.
This
fire.
Is true. Yeah.
Although we should note that it's not actually comical because almost nothing in this movie is funny.
Yeah. What about the lack of sense of humor in this movie?
Do you really think nothing was funny at all?
There's some funny. There are a few. I laughed a few times. I mean, I think it has a few laugh lines. I should also say I'm fine with humorless movies. Like this movie feels of all the Superman movies most like a Christopher Nolan Dark Knight movie, and he produced it or executive produced it. And I really am a big fan of most of those movies, but. This movie just seemed sort of like the most self-aggrandizing movie ever. So, we've talked about the excess, but it just sort of endlessly pummels you. And if it wasn't cutting back to yet another action sequence every 5 minutes where Clark Kent has to decide whether to save people and reveal himself again, then I would have been more willing to go with it, just sort of telling its story in a very serious way. I'm not against, a superhero movie.
Well, it doesn't
want to
send up Superman. It's not trying to send up the seriousness of the character. But at the same time, and this I give it credit for this, it does have some Christopher Nolan elements, but it's also not taking Superman's character and twisting it into this Dark Knight brooding dude.
He's not dark. Yeah, it's definitely, he's still quite noble and all of
and
that.
Sweet. And sweet. And he has a little bit of that Christopher Reeve sweetness. So we should talk about Henry Cavill or Cavill. I don't know where you put the stress on his
Cavill?
On his last name. I haven't heard
I
it
think.
Said yet.
I want to say Cavill, but I don't
That's
know.
That's what I've
British.
Heard in my head, at least, for a long time.
Okay, well, let's Cavill. Let's Cavill about his performance then. I mean, to me, in that this movie does evoke Chris Reeve and the Margot Kidder Chris Reeve Superman, which is completely different in tone, right? But something about the sweetness of the character, I think, is supposed to invoke Chris Reeve. Am I crazy in thinking about that, that was a performance reference for him?
I don't know. It definitely was for the last Superman movie, for Superman Returns. I felt like his performance was nothing really like Christopher Reeve's. It didn't have that sort of, like, Cary Grant screwball.
Sparkle, right? Mm-hmm. It didn't have that sparkle.
Yeah. I think it seems like I thought Cavill was good. He didn't seem like he had a lot to do. You know, a big part of his role is just sort of him hiding who he really is. He's sort of and so he remains pretty subdued. But when he gets a couple sort of like cry yells, I was surprised at the emotional depth that he revealed.
Yeah, that was the
oh,
one.
It's so sad to think that that's the moment that the superhero blockbuster allows you, right? That's your big thespian moment.
Non-verbal.
You can look at this guy, shake your fist, and yell.
Yeah, I definitely thought that he, I guess, physically sort of filled out the role of Superman quite well for me. But he didn't get that much room to act. I mean, it was just kind of like, I'm here, you know, and this is, I'm sort of a physical force in the world as opposed to an emotional one. And we were talking about this earlier. I didn't really buy the romantic element between him and Lois Lane in this.
By Amy Adams, we should say.
Right. And pretty well, I think. But, you know, they kiss at the sort of towards the end, as you expect. But it didn't feel like it was building towards that for me at all. I mean, yeah, they were holding hands occasionally, but they felt more like, I think you said something like
it seems more like they respect each other's work than
crime-solving
buddies or something. And so when they kiss, it just that kind of fell flat because we just didn't have enough internal sort of view into their interiority to even get there for me.
Can I say something about the kiss too? Just that line, the pair of corny lines that followed the kiss were particularly grating in the context of the huge body count of the scene that had just preceded, right?
Yes.
I mean, the moment that they kiss is right after the most Christopher Nolan-esque world-destroying scene in which the city of Metropolis is, you know, I mean, there have to be thousands of people that died in
the scene
that we've
just seen. And this isn't acknowledged at all. No, I was a little put off by that too because, I mean, the sort of big battle scene, it just flattens the city. I mean, probably half of it is gone, and you get nothing, no acknowledgement of that, no sort of, you know, Star Trek-like memorial service or something. It's just,
to me, that's not really – that doesn't fit with the spirit of Superman. And, I mean, I'm sure a bunch of comic book readers are going to descend on me and say, well, in X, Y, and Z series that happens. But at least in the movie Superman that we know, usually every life matters, you know?
Yeah.
There's kind of a sense that, like, if an old lady falls off a skyscraper, you know, I got to get that lady. And, of course, he's saving everyone he can, but, you know, there's bodies and cars flying everywhere. And then after that, they have their big kiss. And then they say these two cutesy things. I can't remember. I think she says, the first kiss is... What is it? He says, they say the first kiss is, it all goes downhill from there or something like that. And he
there,
says, but that doesn't apply
because I'm
not human or something like that.
Yeah, I'm not human.
And
so
it might have been cute in a different context, but man, that was so, that felt so wrong.
And Nolan, I mean, so Nolan in his defense, so every blockbuster in the world destroys a city in it now. Nolan, I think, usually doesn't. He destroys a football stadium. That's a pretty big deal. But normally it's more about society falling into chaos. And that's more interesting. And this movie tries to do that a little bit. Superman, the reason he can't figure out whether to reveal himself is because he's not sure whether to trust people. And that's a big sort of, like, that's all of what The Dark Knight is about, is whether people are basically good and whether Batman can trust them. And the Joker's trying to make them bad. But this movie, it seems pretty obvious that everyone's good. Like, that Kevin Costner is, like, this perfect American heartland farmer father. And so there was really no suspense for it to me. Like,
There's not a social satire. There's not any of that stuff that happens in the Batman movies about, you know, a social satire or some sort of dark vision of totalitarianism. Maybe on Krypton there is, but not on Earth.
Right, but I still think it's supposed to be a big question for Superman. Like, the sort of one of the final lines he gives, we keep jumping ahead to the end, but is, you know, after he kills this drone and then the military comes up and they're sort of figuring out what the relationship is going to be, and then he says, I guess I'll just have to trust you. And that's what he's decided to do, like, over and over again. His decision is, unlike over and over again, his decision is, I'm gonna turn myself into the human people, and they will decide because they are basically good.
All right, let's stop the conversation for just a minute for a word from our sponsor. This episode of the Slate Spoiler Special is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. At Shutterstock, you'll find the perfect video for your next creative project, whether it's a website, an advertisement, a multimedia presentation, or any type of film project. They have over 700,000 high-quality stock video clips, 2D animations, and 3D motion graphics. They have clips in a variety of digital formats, and most come in HD. They source these clips from around the world and put them at your fingertips, adding 10,000 new clips each week, so whenever you visit, you'll find something new. You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. No credit card needed. Just start an account, begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like, and save the video selections you find to your clip box. Once you decide to purchase, use the offer code SPOILER6, and new accounts will receive 30% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com, and for 30% off new accounts, use the offer code SPOILER6. The Spoiler Special thanks Shutterstock for their support. So back to Man of Steel. So as long as we're spoiling, let's get to the return of Zod and the big action, the multiple big action climaxes of the movie that happen after Michael Shannon and his merry crew of bad Kryptonians come back to Earth.
So when Zod shows up, he announces to everyone, it sort of destroys Superman's whole plan of keeping himself secret, because he announces to everyone that they are not alone. He does it in like 8 languages that apparently Michael Shannon and Zod have learned.
He takes over the world's television sets, which again, it seemed a little bit old school. Like that was something that could happen back in the 70s. Everybody gathered around their TV set. Right. He didn't use the internet. He didn't use new media to disseminate his message.
Yeah.
And so he demands that Superman turn himself in or to Zod, or he will destroy the whole Earth, I think is what he says. And so Superman does that, and then we learn there's that weird dream sequence. Where
Zod sort of gets in Superman's head,
his mind,
and tells him what the plan is, which is basically to terraform Earth. So that he can relaunch the Kryptonian species.
That's very graphic novel-y. I have to say that dream sequence is very effectively kind of creates this space that's inside both of their minds. We're clear that it's not really happening, but it's sort of the future being told through Zod's words. And it ends with this really arresting image of Superman sinking into this sea of skulls, which would be, you know, the whole depopulated Earth. It was pretty powerful in its punchy graphic novel way. So we were talking a little bit before taping about how these tentpole blockbusters, which at this point are almost sort of like medieval canon, that have to be respected and you can just tinker around the edges with the aesthetics of it, how they differentiate themselves from one another. And something that stood out in this movie, I don't know that I necessarily loved it, but it was definitely a Zack Snyder signature thing, was the speed at which the final battle between Zod and Superman takes place. So as always, right, with these hyper-technologized battles, it comes down at some moment to just two guys slugging it out, a good guy and a bad guy. And that's happening with Zod and Superman, you know, flying over the city of Metropolis, punching each other. And it is filmed with this kind of, I thought, great clarity and speed. And essentially every punch sends the punchy flying about, I don't know, 5 blocks. And at one point, Zod actually takes Superman's cape
and
like, right. They're kind of like plowing through all the buildings. I guess they're in Smallville at that point, right? Maybe they're not in
Metropolis.
There's two different scenes.
There's two.
Yeah. Where the same thing happens, yeah.
But there's some kind of fun touches in that. And you're able to see what's going on. I mean, it's all done, I imagine most of it is done with computer graphics. Apparently they barely ever put people on wires in this, although the flying looks pretty good. But at one point, Zod takes Superman's cape and kind of wings him around in a circle and sends him flying that way. I mean, there's just some kind of physics jokes, basically, about, you know, bodies flying through space that I thought were kind of well done and unusually done.
Yeah, I mean, Zack Snyder, I think he's just really good at making shit look cool, and this is one of the best examples of that. I mean, he made his name largely with 300, where he did all this speed ramping where he kept slowing things down and then speeding them up again in the middle of an action sequence. And so, yeah, this, you get sort of just the speeding up part and more than ever. And it felt mostly different to me and certainly more convincing than any fight sequence. That
I liked it way more than 300. I mean, this whole movie, this is probably my favorite Zack Snyder movie I've ever seen, but that's not very high praise for me because I think I've pretty much loathed all of his movies up till now.
Yeah, definitely convincing. I mean, I'm not one for the 30-minute action scene at the end of all these movies, but this was you know, gripping. I mean,
it was still way too long, but it had some fun moments in it where it wasn't just like, oh, a truck is coming at me again, bang, right? There was some actual hand-to-hand combat that was kind of thrillingly filmed. You wanted to talk about the music a little bit, Brian, which I experienced essentially as just assaultive percussion, but apparently there's a melody in there that people are humming.
There is. I thought this was some great work from Hans Zimmer. I actually have a post up on Browbeat about the score. And I thought that, I mean, it's definitely him, right? It's a lot of the sort of rushing minor strings and the big brass hits that we learned in Inception and everyone made fun of. And a lot of drumming. I mean, a ton of drumming in this. I think he had a 12-member drum circle that he sort of put together to do a lot of that, those big parts, including...
Do you want to name some of the superstar drummers?
Including Pharrell Williams, but right. Do you know...
Also Sheila E. and Jason Bonham, John Bonham's son.
That's right, yeah.
So I thought it was John Bonham. You're right. It was Jason Bonham.
Yeah, yeah, so he called all these people together. So you've got this huge, I mean, this hugely intense percussive, indeed, and sort of brassy sound that's very Zimmer. And I happen to like it. I mean, you might think it's noise. I think it's a sort of, I call it like dramatic minimalism because it kind of builds, he does this thing where he starts out very softly and then layers build upon layers, build upon layers, and then you have, you know, a big hit and then it sort of dissolves back into the ether. But
well, the curious thing for me is just that there was a melody in there. Can we just stop for a minute and maybe play the melody so other people can, unlike me, pick it out when they see the movie?
Yeah, this is like a hope theme for sure. This sort of little bittersweet piano melody that it gets transformed as, you know, a theme does in a movie. It sometimes it's played very simply, and that's sort of the Kansas like Ma Kent moment. And other times it's orchestrated such that it's more noble and more heroic. But I thought it was sort of classic film scoring stuff. I mean, and it harkened back to some degree to John Williams's work on the original movies, which is, you know, so iconic. Without having to quote him or even really riff on that theme, it carried through the spirit in a useful way. And like Forrest mentioned, there are all kinds of YouTube videos of like drummers playing to this thing, and it's sort of gone viral weirdly.
Yeah.
I think it was a successful score. I mean, in our theater, at least, I thought they played everything too loud. Like, the speakers were too loud.
Yeah, I wasn't sure whether that was the score or...
I think if you listen to the score, you know, on the album, it's much more balanced and nuanced than it came through in the screening we were at. But, you know, hopefully people will go out and check it out that way.
Any film score that goes viral and people are going around playing drums too, that's, I'm good with that. Okay, wait, one last thing we haven't mentioned, which I think is pretty big, is Michael Shannon making his, you know, sort of supervillain debut. I was really excited that he was going to be playing the supervillain. Love Michael Shannon. I mean, I don't think it's really his fault necessarily, but he seemed ill at ease and lost in that role to me. And I just kept thinking, like, collect your paycheck, you know, go home, do lots of interesting theater with it, and please never do this again. You know, that was how I felt about Shannon as Zod.
Yeah, I felt that way too. Before we went to see the movie, you know, some people were, whenever anybody was less excited about it, the one thing I kept falling back on is I've never seen a Michael Shannon movie.
And I'm not imagining you at dinner trying to get your friends to see Man of Steel.
God, it's Michael Shannon.
Shannon did it.
Yeah, there are some there who are takers on that. And this was, I think, the most boring performance I've seen from him. I think I liked it more than you did. I thought he was good, but it was not, it didn't, I mean, you know, he often packs in these eccentricities and like this thing where he blinks his eyes in sort of very deliberate ways.
And he can be so terrifying. I mean, he's always so terrifying. And in this one role where he needs to be the most terrifying, he wasn't. I mean, I think he was deliberately trying to not chew scenery and not do a hammy performance and be very still and restrained. And that would be where the threat would come from. And I don't know that that was necessarily his mistake. But I don't know. To me, it just seemed like he wasn't enjoying himself.
Yeah.
So at the moment at the end that we see Henry Cavill as Clark Kent walk in and unconvincingly hide his identity behind glasses, is the implication that there will be more Superman movies, and should we expect more, and do you guys want more?
Yeah, I definitely want more. I was impressed by this reboot. I think it has legs, and I think they could absolutely go further. And now that everything's in place, we won't have to have as much of the mythology that Forrest didn't like. And we've got everyone sort of where they need to be for the main line of the canon story. So I think they absolutely could go. I think that would be fine. I'd be happy to see another one.
Yeah, I would definitely go see another one. I think the cast is great. I think. You know, pretty much all of the elements here are really promising, except for the script, maybe. It was probably the biggest problem for me, and I think that's something they could correct for a lot of the reasons that you suggested. So I would go to another Man of Steel movie.
Yeah, I would give these guys one more chance. I do hope that they take the Russell Crowe kind of holodeck character out of commission, because it seems like it lessens the significance of the loss of his father, that essentially Jor-El can just sort of pop up on a computer program, and not Marlon Brando style where he's repeating the same loop, but right. He's like an interactive hologram of himself or something like that.
So you have to admit it was wonderful when he's leading Lois Lane around the alien ship at that one point where it's Jor-El and Lois, and there's this like funny scene where he's just like, turn right, turn left, shoot over your shoulder.
Yeah.
I thought that was funny. It was like making fun of it a little bit.
I mean, I agree with what you said, Dana, but as just a bit of sci-fi, that idea of having his consciousness like still alive in that ship was super interesting, and that like pin screen effect they kept using to give all the exposition was really cool.
Oh yeah, that was like a Spencer Gifts item.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
All right, well guys, thank you very much, and if there is another Man of Steel movie, please come back and spoil it with me.
I'm in.
Absolutely.
Our producer is Chris Wade. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Andy Bowers. For Slate.com, I'm Dana Stevens.